or Highgate. They used to make a extremely rugged fan dipole kit. It was a combination of trap and fan dipole. They had a number of different models. The reason I bring it up, it's been a long, long time. I don't know if they still make it, but years ago a friend of mine had put one up, and I was quite impressed with it because the wire was a very, very heavy, I don't know what it was, if it was aluminum or what, but it didn't rust, it didn't break, it was up, I don't think it was aluminum. It was too stiff to be aluminum. And they used clamps with screws to hold it around the insulators. It was a very, very rugged, rugged antenna. I think, check it out, I seem to remember the 80 and 40 meter version was called the 2TTQ or something like that, and then they had other models. I don't know if they still make it, but if anything, it was overbuilt. Probably just what you need, Lou, N2RQ and 2EO in the group.
It's Radio Works, got the same product using copper weld wire, Dick.
And KC2QIQ is coming.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, there's a website on called hamuniverse.com, and they show a beautiful diagram with all of the exact measurements and lengths and all of the components needed to produce a fan, beautiful fan dipole from basically, you know, 80 through 10 meters. And you can even sneak your warp bands in between there if you wanted to. And, I mean, it's a simple enough thing to do. And if, I would just say type in on Google fan dipole at hamuniverse.com. And it's something that even if you want to have students put this thing together, it's such a simple thing to put up and very, very simple. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
KY.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, Lou, go to RadioWorks.com. They have them already, I believe, in kits. The wire they use is called copper weld wire. Very good copper. It's very strong stuff. I've used it on my dipole, number 14 or number 12, copper weld. And it's tough stuff. I've never had a dipole break with copper weld, and I'm talking about one dipole that I have that is 160 meters, 200 and some, let's see, 250 feet approximately, 270 feet to be exact, of the dipole. And so with copper weld, you'll never go wrong. And I can say RadioWorks.com, and they got the whole setup there if you need it. I can say commercial name on it. That's just a vice. Board of Ed, over.
So for those who have been listening, we've been making suggestions for copper antennas for the Stuyvesant High School and Brooklyn Tech High School. With any other comments before we close this one down for tonight, and we can open up it again next week, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW. Okay, let's go over to Paul. I hope we haven't put you to sleep, Paul. And I know you had some comments, had some reports on what NASA is doing. WS2N, if you're there, KQRIW in the TechNet. Make sure you do a better job than me of looking at your watch.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on it. And let me see if I have this thing. I don't think I do. Very good, okay. Yeah, not too much, Dick. I just wanted to mention STS-131 is still up there. So that's a 13-day mission, and I think they're going to do a second spacewalk today if they haven't, and maybe tomorrow. And there's only 3 space shuttles left to go up. You know, this is they're getting down to the wire here. Now, I'm going to be interested to find out, I believe it's April 14th, President Obama is supposed to be going down to Florida, down to Cape Kennedy. And I wonder if they're going to make any kind of announcements or changes. Hopefully, maybe they'll bring back the Constellation program or maybe part of it. I don't know what they're going to do. But I just can't believe it's going to go down there. I mean, what's happened is that they basically have canceled the manned space program after this. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And he'll be down there when STS-31 is still in orbit. Drop it. Okay, last week we discussed the Messenger spacecraft, among others. And I think you were wondering when that was going to go into orbit around Mercury. And I did get an accurate website to go to. They actually have a countdown to it. They tell you how many days it's been up there. For instance, today it's been up there 2,011 days. And they say there's 340 days left. And the day it's going to go into Mercury orbit will be in March 18th of 2011, of next year. It was launched there, 2004, some 4 billion miles so far it's traveled around and around, and that's going to be the first spacecraft ever to orbit Mercury. You can go to that website to they have a lot of information about the spacecraft and the orbit. You can see how it's going to go into orbit, science on board and the reasons behind it. Let me drop it. I'll give you the website. Naturally, HTTP/, my computer, I don't have to do that. You just put in messenger.jhuapl.edu. Messenger, M-E-S-S-E-N-G-E-R, dot J-H-U, Juliet Hotel Uniform, A-P-L, Apple, Papa Lima, dot edu for education. And that's a very nice website for them. If you have trouble doing that, you can always go to Google, put in Messenger spacecraft homepage, and you'll wind up going to the same place. So that takes care of Messenger. I wanted to mention the Mars Spirit and Opportunity Spirit has been stuck in the sand for many months. And they can't seem to get it out of there. And now they've run out of time. The Mars winter is upon it. So this will be the third Mars winter for the ES2 spacecraft. And right now they do have it pointing the best they can to the north, because Mars Spirit is in the southern plane. Drop it. For the last couple of weeks, they haven't heard from it, and they believe it has gone into a shutdown mode to conserve its power, using all its available power to supply the batteries to keep them warm. And it's kind of like a human, when you get cold, your body starts shutting down your fingers and your extremities. And the idea is to keep the core of your body warm, your heart and your brain and all. But same thing here. So they expected it to contact Mars Odyssey, one of the orbiting spacecraft, and send information back a while back. But that didn't happen. So their prediction is that the power got so low that it went into a safe mode. They predict after the winter that it will probably try to make contact again with spacecraft up above the planet. That's pretty much it for Mars Spirit and Mars Opportunity. That just keeps going. Let me drop it. Opportunity is still operating, and that is up to date. It's driven, they said, 20 kilometers. So, here's the thing that was supposed to last 3 months, and then that was January of 2004 when those two spacecraft landed there. One was on January 3rd, the other one was on January 14th. And here we are in 2010. And it's still going. So, pretty much it about all I wanted to mention, STS-131, Messenger, and Opportunity, and we'll discuss further probably unmanned missions next year. we'll have to concentrate on unmanned spaceflight. Hopefully not, though. Back to you, Ed, WS-20.
Yes, Spirit Design Number has its front right wheel non-operative, and therefore it's got to drag it by backing up. Good old Opportunity, properly named. That's the real Energizer bunny here. My goodness. January of 2004 to now, and still running with 20 kilometers under its belt. To your knowledge, are all six wheels running on Opportunity? And is there funding to keep using it? Over to you, Paul.
I know the funding comes up like every 6 months or so. They keep getting these extensions. And the reason why, if you were to build these identical spacecraft, of course you're fortunate to send them to Mars. All they have to do is just refund the paycheck of the operators and people that are involved at JPL in California. And it's very low low cost. You know, they're already there. So you do have a Mars Science Laboratory eventually going up, which will originally they were thinking about two spacecraft, but it's just going to be one, and that will land on Mars, and that will probably be similar to this thing. Will probably ride for years. It'll not solar powered. It's got a nuclear regenerative thermocouple type of heating system. What do they call them things? RTG, I think it is. So they're there. So they'll keep going. The wheels on Opportunity, I heard, are okay. It's actually two wheels now that are non-functioning on Spirit, so that thing's in bad, bad trouble, Dick. Now, the good news is that the scientists really don't care if this thing gets stuck there. They'll leave it there, and they could do a lot of science that they wouldn't normally attempt to do with a robot that's moving. You know, they'll dig deeper or do different things that they don't normally do, or spin wheels, or who knows, and then take pictures. What I have read is that scientists would be very happy if Spirit never moved again, and the thing will sit there for years on end. They said that this thing does not have an off switch. You can't send a signal up to shut it down, so it could be sending information back for months or even years to come. They designed it like that because they didn't want somebody to accidentally and inadvertently send the program up. You know, you send hundreds of programs up to this thing every time you turn around. And they didn't want to send the wrong one up and have it shut itself down. So there's no off switch. Back to you, Dick.
And one last question. The Mars Science Laboratory, any idea when that's due to be launched and land?
I'll have to check. Originally it was 2011, but I guess that's delayed. I would put it at it's every 26 months that Earth and Mars come around. You know, we go around the sun once, and then Mars will go halfway around its orbit. It's roughly a 2-to-1 ratio, so by the time we go around again for a second year, then Mars comes around at that next time, that other half, and matches up with Earth. So that's why it's not 2 years. It's really like 26 months. But I would put it at 2013 if that is. I believe that's the landing date now.
Thank you for that information, Paul. I like manned spaceflight, but I got to admit that you get an awful lot of bang for the dollar. out of unmanned spacecraft. These things can be up there for years making measurements. And to put a man there would be very difficult to sustain him, if you could afford to get him there. Okay. Well, I think it's time for our mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW, we're kind of in the 168 questions, what kind of a common denominator, if there was one.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I got my selection here. Well, the time left, I'll tell you something that has reoccurred a number of times. I've been sort of trying to boil this down to questions that are, you know, more or less repetitious, that seem to show a lot of interest with a lot of young hands, especially, and even some people that already been a few years into the hobby, and things that they've been pondering they don't quite understand. In other words, they can't get to the next step because not quite understanding what the point is that they've gotten to. And so one of them is something that we have discussed on antennas. I was going to do something on receivers again tonight, but with the time left, I think I better pass up on it. I think we'll take this question about antennas, Dick, over.
Sounds like the right thing to do. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. One of the questions they asked, a number of times we've discussed antennas, and we'll say that the measurement was, let's say, let me say 27 ohms resistive plus 36 ohms reactive, plus J or minus J, something R minus J or plus J. How do we get this plus or minus J factor? And how can you measure that with very simple instruments? Nothing involved, say, just basically with an SWR meter, Dick, over.
I can think of a way of doing it. Not elegant, but to a smart person, it'll lead you in the right direction. If you have reason to believe your antenna is not resonant, usual definition of resonance is that there is no J term. There is no reactive term. It's just a pure resistor of some kind. The quickest way I can think to find that out would be to take the antenna and right across the terminals of the antenna, put a reactor, a small capacitor, a couple of picofarad. If, for instance, the antenna was slightly inductive, it had positive J, putting a small capacitor across the antenna, which is negative J, would give partial correction. So just by putting a small capacitor, if the standing wave ratio got better, you know that the J you had was positive because you just added a small amount of negative and it got better. And slowly make that that capacitor larger and larger until you no longer get any improvement. Correspondingly, let me drop. If the antenna already is capacitive and you add a small capacitor across it, the standing wave ratio will get worse. You had minus J because the antenna was capacitive. That's what minus J means. And adding more capacitance in shunt, that's the easiest way to do it. It'd be nice if you could do it in series, but mechanically that's more difficult. If it gets worse, you know in the wrong direction, and then you could put a large inductor. Like at first it's going to sound crazy. I'm doing this test with a small capacitor because I want to make sure that I don't go too far and get confused. I want to crawl up on it, so to speak. So I take a small number of picofarads. You can do that with a simple piece of copper tape that you bend the right way to make a straight capacitor. You stand back and with a long thin wooden dowel, you push the piece of copper foil. If the copper foil is making direct contact to one terminal of the antenna, and there's some paper tape over the other terminal to make sure you don't get a short circuit, and you slowly push the copper tape against it and see what happens to the standing wave ratio. Not elegant, but it'll give you a pretty darn good answer if you know what you're doing. And In the case of an inductor, it's a little bit less convenient, but you want to start off with a fairly large inductor so that it has a rather large inductive reactance when you're putting it in shunt, so that it doesn't overpower the circuit, and then slowly lower the inductor by either choosing other inductors that are slightly lower or putting another one in parallel with the one you've got there. So by doing testing, probing, so to speak, and seeing which way it goes, that's one way to do it. There's more elaborate ways, but I wonder if you know of a simpler way than that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I started pondering this thing many, many years ago when I was a young ham. And the only way I had, if you want to measure even any kind of SWR, was the days when I had 300 ohm feed line and I was using a couple of number 47 panel lights in cadets and lamps on that feed line to tape that feed line wired to with the lamps, what would they were called back to back at the time. And so one lamp would light bright and the other one light a little dimmer, and that was my so-called SWR indicator. First of all, I think you know what I'm talking about, Dick, over.
Yes, I do. If you choose the right kind of a light bulb and connect it the correct way to a sampling piece of twin lead that you run in parallel with the main transmission line, which is twin lead, there may be a way also of building a version of that where with coaxial cable you snake a piece of enameled wire under the braid, but that would be a little more difficult. So I'm guessing you did this with twin lead and maybe something like number 47 volts, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. Now, with the coming of coax, I had no more way of doing it with the two lamps. As Dick just said, we used number 47 lamps, which was a common lamp known as a pilot light, the old radio that they glowed in the dock. Well, the pan that lit up the dial, the band spread dial, and also lit up also the S meters and thing, or was on the panel as the power on of red light would come on or whatever. So it was a very popular lamp called the number 47 panel light. Now, with coming of coax, remember, right after World War II, coax started to take hold. It was an exotic cable before World War II. Very few hands had coax cable. Most everything was something like open wire feeders that, well, have been resurrected quite a bit, open wire feeding, and does work quite well. However, being that most everybody seems to be into the coax, let me let it drop. I thought about this problem years ago, and with coax cable, I put together a simple SWR bridge, which, of course, many of the articles in QSC and magazines showed how to put together a simple SWR bridge, with only needing a couple of diodes and a couple of pieces of metal and a potentiometer and everything, and fairly easy to calibrate it up. However, when I got into looking at antennas as complex, and the situation when the SWR was changed from 1 to 1, 1.5 to 1 or whatever, I wanted to know, what the heck is this factor, this reactance factor, and how do you go about, you know, making a measurement? So, thought about it, finally I think I came up that time with a simple answer, which I have suggested a number of people, and they use it, and that's why I think I will describe right now. Let me let it drop. Again, now we're going to go back to the old Smith chart. I know the Smith chart, I did a number of different sessions on the Smith chart, but here's one I really didn't do. So I thought that I drew up one, and I thought I'd give you a very interesting way of making this measurement. And let me, you can just write it down. If you don't have a Smith chart handy, I'm sure you don't. You can just write down what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you an example, and you can do it yourself. And not only you'll learn a little bit more about using the Smith chart, but you'll find something very interesting that you can look at as your antenna. Let me let it drop again. Hey, here's what I did. I took an SWR measurement, and for argument's sake, this was at 14 megahertz, 20 meters, 14.0, and I found I have an actual measurement of an SWR of 3.01. In other words, my SWR was reading 3. Okay. I then took a 25-ohm resistor. Now, it was 50-ohm load, supposedly, 50-ohm cable. I then took a 25-ohm resistor, and I put it in series with my meter. It was in series. So now I was measuring, took the SWR measurement again, and now I've got a 2.0 SWR. I hope I'm not confusing anybody at this point, Dick. Over.
I don't think so. So you started with a 3-to-1. You put a 25-ohm resistor in series, probably with the center conductor of the coax cable. Made a second measurement. Now it's 2-to-1. Over to you, Mel.
Okay. So now I have a 2-to-1. Now, to get my reactant, what I have... Well, I normalized the 25-ohm resistor because I was going to do a Smith chart plot. So by dividing it by 50, I've got 0.5. That's what we call normalizing it. So I took my chart, my Smith chart, I made two circles. One with my 3.0. First circle we'll call circle 1 with the SWR of 3. The second circle with the added resistor, an SWR of 2. And this is drawn on the Smith chart. Let it drop again. Okay, now, because I added this resistor to the second circle, I subtracted from the center of the Smith chart, I subtracted the 0.5. That's what I normalized, that 25-ohm resistor. I subtracted the 0.5, that gave me 1.5 on the main axis of the Smith chart, and I added to the original circle, the 3, which before, because I didn't put the resistor in that time, I added that 0.5. So now I have 2 points that I have. I have a 1.5, which you can write this down, and I have a 3.5 on the Smith chart. Let me let it drop. Using these 2 points, I took my compass again, and I swung a third circle. Where did third circle now cross the second circle? You'll see, you read the 2 points where they intersect, and you get the two different spots. You get now here comes the plus and the minus, and you'll see it's 0.55, and you've got the situation plus or minus 0.72. J, in other words, that's that J, what we talked about, the J factor, J plus or minus 7.2. So now we know that we have 2 points, and it's either or. Now, which one of the 2 points, and I'll tell you how I find which one it is. This is reading of 0.55 and plus or minus 7.2, and I normalized it, and I got 27 ohms resistive and 36 ohms reactive. So I said, okay, which one is it now? Okay, so I converted the 36 ohms reactive, and I converted that to capacitance. And what I did, I've got approximately around 300 PF. I took a simple old-fashioned variable capacitor that I have from my a radio, and what I did, I put it in to the circuit, and now I wanted to see something. If I put in series now, if the reactant of the load would be inductive, the resultant VSWR would be greater. And then the original, the reactant is capacitive. Did I say that right? No, it's... I want to determine whether if this is X of C greater or equal to X of L. If the resulting VSWR is less than the original VSWR, the reactance of the load is inductive. If the resultant VSWR is greater than the original, then the reactance will be capacitive. So in other words, I use the capacitors. By tuning that capacitor, basically, you see if the SWR is going up or down. That'll determine whether it's plus or minus J. I hope I explained that right, Dick. Go ahead.
There was one part that wasn't quite clear, Mel. On the Smith chart, you from the center of the chart, you drew a circle of what we call magnitude 2. You chose the 2 on the right-hand side. That's the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio circle. And also from the center of the chart, you drew a 3-to-1 circle. Those two were clear. Then you drew a third circle, but you didn't tell us where the center of that circle was. Well, you did tell us that it's a 0.5 circle, and it spanned 1.5 to 3.5. I'm not quite sure where the center of that circle is, and was it swung the full 360 degrees. So the circle you swung, giving you the 1.5 and the 3.5, I think some extra words are required to say what you did in that operation. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, yeah, you're right. I'll make it a little clearer. The first circle is very easy. We swung the 3.360. 3 point SWR. The second circle, again, straightforward, using the center point, the 1.0 effect of the chart, and a 2.0 SWR. So complete 360. The third circle, how I determined the third circle, being that I used a 25 ohm resistor, and I normalized that to 0.5 ohms. That's what I normalized it. The feet divided by the 25 gives me 0.5. It's the normalized value of the point, the 25 ohm resistor.
Mel, your push-to-talk switch is becoming intermittent. You have to squeeze a little harder.
Hey, I'm sorry. The point I just said that after I swung the second circle, that's the 2.0 SWR circle, 360 degrees. Is that clear, over?
Yeah, that's very clear. Go right ahead.
Okay, to get the third circle, because I normalized the 25 ohm resistor to 0.5 ohms, and I subtracted now that 0.5 that I just normalize from the center and gives me 1.5 on the Smith chart on the center axis. I added that 0.5 to the 3 circle that gave me 3.5. Those 2 points, do you follow, Dick? Over.
Yes, we definitely got those 2 points on the horizontal axis. And now you're about to put a compass somewhere and swing another circle, and that you got to go a little slow on. Go ahead.
Okay, now taking the compass, putting the pin of the compass at 1.5, opening the compass to the 3.5 mark on the axis, swing a 360-degree circle, and you'll see that it'll intersect circle number 2, that 2.0, at 2 spots. How's that clear? Over.
I know where the 1.5 dot is and the 3.5 dot. I think you're saying that I put the center of the circle on 1.5. I put the pencil, I put the center of the compass on 1.5. I put the pencil of the compass on 3.5, and I swing a 360 circle. And yes, I can see how they're going to intersect. Certainly it's going to intersect the 3. Is it also going to... I don't think it's going to intersect the 2, Mel. It's going to intersect the 3-to-1 circle, but that may not intersect the 2-to-1 circle. Go ahead.
It intersects the 2.0 circle at 2 spots, Dick. Definitely intersects. In fact, that's your 2 measurement spots where it actually is where you're measuring the reactance, because that's where you... The 2.0 circle is actually where we introduce this resistor. So it intersects the circle number 2 at 2 points, Dick. Over.
if you are putting the center of the compass, the point of the compass, the sharp point that doesn't have a pencil, on the 3.5 dot, and you put the pencil of the compass on 1.5 and swung it, no sweat. But you set it the other way around, the sharp point at 1.5 and the pencil on 3.5, and now that does not intersect the two when I swing a 360 from there. Over to you, Mel.
I put the, I swing the compass, how the heck did I do this now? I swung the compass with the pin at, let's see now, how the heck did I do this? Get her in, you know. Okay. Okay, that's right. I put the pin, let me see, I put the pin on the 1.5. That's right, that's what I'm doing. I'm confusing myself. I put the pin on 1.5, on the 1.5, and on the the pencil point is the span. In other words, the span is at the 3.5, and you swing the circle so it intersects. Yeah. Circle number two at 2.6. If you do it, you'll see it work. If you have the pin at 1.5, over.
Okay, the simple diagram I drew is probably not accurate. And by the way, when you did what you described, the circle, the new third circle that you're going to swing, it's going to intersect both the 3-to-1 circle and the 2-to-1 circle. I think you're only going to care about where it intersects the 2-to-1 circle. Back to you, Mel.
Actually, the 3 was just to get a measurement point, you know, a reference point, because we're adding to the 3, the 0.5 that we are resistant, and we're subtracting the 0.5 from circle number 2, because that's when we added the series resistance. So that way, we now put this third circle, we're interested in the third circle where it actually intersects circle number 2. And at those 2 points, those are the 2 points that actually present the reactance measurement point. Stick over.
I think you're about to say you now have a 2-to-1 ambiguity. One of those intersections is the real impedance of this 3-to-1 antenna, and now you're about to do a test to find out, is it the plus J or the minus J intercept of the 2-to-1 circle. Now back to you.
Now I recomputed back, I took those 2 points that I just measured, and it happened to be, I just did the experiment. I haven't done this in a long time, but if I don't use this type of way anymore, I've got a more modern way of doing it with, you know, more sophisticated instruments. So I have on there now, I see it intersects circle number 2 at the 2 points at 0.55 plus or minus J0.72. That's where now the third circle is intersecting the second circle. Is that clear enough? Over.
Yes, I think it is. And the 0.55 times 50 ohms is what gives you the 27, I think. Go ahead.
Exactly. So I get 27.5 ohms resistance. And normalizing, going backwards the other way, with multiplying it by 50, the 0.72 J factor gives me 36 ohm reactive. Is that following you easily enough? Over.
Yep, I think I see what you've done. So that test resistor is giving you a lot of information with one slight 2-to-1 ambiguity, and I think you're about to resolve that.
Okay, after I did this now, I have, if I've determined the resistance and the reactive components of the load, have been determined. Now the VSWR is measured again with the capacitive reactance, X of C is a greater or equal to X of L, and placed in series with the load. If the resulting VSWR is less than the original, the reactance of the load is inductive. if the resultant VSWR now becomes greater than the original VSWR, the reactant is capacitive, meaning minus. So that way now with a simple variable capacitor, like from an old AM radio, that's what I used to use, you know, 104-365 TF capacitors, I immediately know whether I'm plus or minus J and what my exact reactant, resistance and reactant is on my antenna with just a simple SWR bridge, Dick, over.
Yeah, that is a lot of information with very little test equipment, just a 25-ohm resistor. Quite crafty. How did you come about doing this particular one, Mel? Because in the normal instruction with a Smith chart, I don't think they show you this one. Go ahead.
Not at all. That's why all of a sudden, you know, when they started asking me these questions, I started thinking back and I said, you know, I came up with this a long, long time ago. Yeah, well, I sat on it. When I sit on a train, Dick, people, you know, read and do things. I doodle. I make circuits. I draw circuits and things like that. And, you know, the Smith chart is always sort of in my mind when every time I think of antennas. So I was picturing, you know, what happens if you add resistance of different values into a measurement. What happens to it? You know, where is, how does it replot? And of course, like you say, the Smith chart, if you swing the circle, let's face it, if you swing a circle, right, it intersects, the circle is going to pass through all the resistive and reactive tags. It's like the 3.10 that we originally drew. It's going to pass through everything that possibly falls on that circle, Dick, over.
Yep, and those numbers you gave me, I see how it falls into 2.97, close enough to 3 to 1. And, huge. So sitting on the train, was that the GG train? Go ahead. The one that went from the independent line that went near Pratt Institute?
BMT, I used to change over to BMT and all to take me to the local line because where I got off in where I lived that time was a local stop. So I got the change to the local BMT. Yeah, I used to, like I say, I used to figure out all kinds of ideas and playing. I was always playing with that Smith chart from the day I first saw this thing way back. I doodled so many different Smith charts. And I think I just, you know, just drawing circles with different SWRs, and I said, boy, oh boy, look at this. It actually does spot with simple measurements. So here you know, they usually suggest you make these measurements, get a noise bridge and all that kind, you need a transceiver and all. Well, here you're just taking your SWR bridge that you most likely have already, and just a simple 25-ohm resistor and an old variable capacitor, and you got all the instrumentation, which was going to give you a good buck over.
They pushed the tossing switch, did slip out a couple of times at times, very briefly. Very crafty. I'm going to have to study this one some more. I could have used that. Why'd you take so long to tell me this one, Mel? Alrighty. We've got about 5 minutes. Your choice if you think we should try another brief one, or should we start signing off? It's your choice. You got it, Mel.
Oh, if I was really crafty, what you could do, you could take this and translate this into a program. So all you'd have to do is feed it to the program, the VSWR measurement, with originally without the resistor, put in then the resistor and get this other measurement, the VSWR with the added resistor, and come up with the reactive load directly. So, I mean, we have to draw it on the Smith chart. I think there are methods. I think they call them a digital Smith chart. Do you know anything about that, Dick, over?
Well, I've written myself a program which is a digital Smith chart. It's not a display. Smith chart-like measurements I do with a couple of equations. as the way I do it on a day-to-day basis. My son also has been working on a computer program that draws Smith charts for various situations. There may be a couple of programs out there that do it, but it might not be freeware. And I think I told you about the so-called Berkeley website. Berkeley has got a beautiful program, freeware, which nicely illustrated. You just plug in your numbers for what you measure, and it tells you 18 or 16 solutions immediately with the picture diagram of the solution as to what's the right way to make an impedance matching network for that situation. Berkeley's got a beautiful program that does that. K2KEY, K2RIW, I think we got about 3 minutes.
Hey, because what I'm thinking of is you come up with a program, or maybe there is something like this available. Instead of using the 25 ohm resistor, we could use different value resistors and come up with different plots. I would say, because I guess you wouldn't have to stick to a 25. I just happened to think a 25 ohm resistor because it was 50% of the 50 ohm. And I figured this way would be maybe easier to convert over and everything. But, you know, I was doing this with slide rules, a lot of calculations and everything. But I guess you wouldn't have to stick to a 25 ohm resistor. I guess you could use a number of different value resistors and get several plots over.
I'm sure there's a way of changing the procedure you just described and get several solutions. And by way of the several solutions, you'll take out some of the errors. In other words, on one of the solutions, you'll come up with 27.5 and 36. On another one, you come up with 27 and 37 and so on. And by using some kind of majority logic, you'll get a refined answer. And there's also a way you can be checking. So it's a very nice technique for resolving an ambiguity. I have, what I use every day is a set of so-called antenna test tools. There's a whole bunch of long, thin sticks with various sizes of copper tape on the end of them. Let me drop. And the copper tape is attached to the end of the stick, small, medium, and large ones, a whole bunch of different sizes. And the copper tape is conductive on one side and non-conductive on the other. You can put a sheet of paper against it, so to speak. These are copper tape off of a reel, and I didn't peel off the paper that was on it, just attached at the end of the stick with the paper, and that way I can hold these tuning tools against various portions of an antenna or near the feed line, the feed line feed point, and so on, and I can add stray capacitance to various places of an antenna, and it gives me a lot of information while watching a network analyzer. And I could do a simplified version of that while watching a standing wave ratio meter, but it would be a little more difficult. Okay, let me drop. You guys have participated in the TechNet number 1,292 of the series that began in 1982, 27 years ago, 27 and a half years ago. Try to be kind to each other. Go easy. And help your fellow amateurs learn how this stuff works. That's what we're trying to do here. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. And, Mel, you've got it.
Thank you very much for the emails. And like I said, try to pick out ones that make sense here. Give it a try, Dick. And let me know how you make out with it. Another nice thing, you don't have to stick to a 50-ohm system here. I can maneuver this around. I can go up, you know, go up and use 300. In fact, plot a 300 ohm using 300 ohm line and use this basically the same idea. So give it a shot, and you know, when you get a chance, doodle a Smith chart and see what you think about this method, if it's something unique. And let me know next time around you have a chance during the week. 73 is all. Good night. K2KEY.
Yeah, I think at 14 megafractals it would work like a charm. And at the higher UHF frequencies, because there are extremely small surface mount resistors that have very little stray inductance, I could use it again. Gotta give it some thought. Bye-bye.